Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Coming home. What are the reasons that prompt adults to join the Catholic Church? And how has this decision impacted on their lives? We find out more. Joy and laughter. We talk to the staff of a UK hospice and discover that nowadays, with efficient palliative care, it's no longer a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill patients die in agony. But first, we have a report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday General Audience.
Pope Benedict made an appeal on Wednesday for the victims of a devastating earthquake which hit a number of provinces in China on Monday. The Holy Father said his thoughts at this time were with all those affected by the disaster that has caused grave loss of life, left many displaced, and caused major damage.
Il mio pensiero va in questo momento alle popolazioni del Sichuan e delle province limitrofe in Cina duramente colpite dal terremoto.
The Pope added that he was spiritually near to all those who have been affected by the earthquake and offered his fervent prayers asking God to relieve their suffering. He also offered support to those who are helping to provide relief. Pope Benedict made his appeal in St. Peter's Square during his weekly general audience, where he also returned to his catechesis on the fathers of the Church, focusing this week on the figure of Dionysius the Areopagite.
Into this catechesis we turn to the teaching of a 16th century author whose writings have been attributed to the first century disciple of St. Paul, Dionysius the Areopagite. His two principal works strive to present a knowledge of God which surpasses rational understanding and culminates in spiritual perfection and transforming contemplation.
The Holy Father went on to say that this 6th century author influenced a number of great saints.
By contemplating what God is not, and by entering more deeply into the rich symbolic language of Scripture, we grow in our relationship with the One who reveals Himself in hiddenness. Contemplation is thus an ascent leading from purification to illumination, perfection, and union with God. In the West, Dionysius' writings influence the early scholastics, St. Bonaventure and St. Thomas, as well as St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross. His vision of a great cosmic harmony reflecting the beauty of the creature and the love freely bestowed on us in Christ can also inspire our efforts to work for unity, reconciliation, and peace in our world.
Speaking in Italian on the figure of Dionysius, who promoted closer relations between the Greek culture and the Christian faith in the 6th century, Pope Benedict pointed out that dialogue between Christians along with other religions is not born out of superficiality, but the truth, and it is also where one enters into a deep relationship with Christ who opens up space for the light of truth. Also today, the Holy Father said, that dialogue is close to God and the truth.
Si vede così che il dialogo non nasce dalla superficialità.
Before bestowing his apostolic blessing on all those gathered, the Pope greeted all those English-speaking pilgrims who had made it to St. Peter's Square.
I welcome all the English-speaking visitors present today, including the groups from England, Ireland, Japan, the Philippines, Trinidad and Tobago, and the United States of America. May your visit to Rome be a time of deep spiritual renewal. Upon all of you, invoke God's abundant blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
How often do you hear reports about the number of Catholics who drift away from the Church each year? The chances are that the phenomenon of lapsed Catholics is much more publicised and debated than the other side of the same coin, namely those people who decide to convert to Catholicism each year. And figures suggest that in many countries of the world, the number of those formerly being received into the Church is on the increase. In the US alone, tens of thousands of adults are received into the Catholic Church during the Easter Vigil ceremony each year. And throughout the world, greater or smaller numbers of adults from all religious backgrounds or none are joining the Catholic Church every year. In the UK, Father Dennis Sarsfield is the chaplain that heads the Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults, or RCIA, in the Archdiocese of Westminster, London. I asked him first, what was the most common reason for people deciding to join the Catholic Church?
I think if we have someone coming from another denomination, there's a sense of doctrinal tradition, I think a continuity of tradition within the church. Other people just sense that if they come to the cathedral here, there's a draw of the actual cathedral itself. People are very struck by the prayerful atmosphere. Other people just say the sense of coming home, really, that they feel they're in the right place. It's hard to actually pin down, but I think those two things, people are searching for the truth, really, and I think the Catholic Church can give that.
Do these people come from all backgrounds and ethnic groups, or is there often a recurring feature, shall we say, amongst them?
Yeah, in general, they come from all over the world, different backgrounds.
I gather that this year, one lady was received into the Catholic Church who received her instruction almost entirely by email. Is this a new development?
I think in this day and age, people have contact with the church all different kinds of ways. But in general, I think it's best to have a face-to-face contact with people.
And I gather that this lady, in fact, lives in Turkey. Can you tell us a little bit more about this case?
Yeah, apparently she has very little. She lives in a very remote area in Turkey, and she contacted one of our staff here in London. She lives 300 miles from the nearest Catholic church, and she was married to a Muslim who was very tolerant towards her Christian faith. She has four grown-up children. She contacted Monsignor Keith Bartrop, who runs the evangelization centre here in England. And so it seems to go very well, a very unusual case. She was accepted over the internet, and the actual catechesis was done online.
Do you have any other unusual, touching or unlikely anecdotes about people who you have dealt with, who have been received into the Catholic Church over the past few years? Any particular case that stands out in your mind?
I suppose everyone who comes is unique and they have their own story. I've been running the RCA course here for 3 years. So the two questions I look for in every case is some sense of conversion. They have an experience converting towards Christ, but also towards the Catholic Church. So we have a large majority of people coming from Anglican churches or other Christian denominations. Well, there was just one interesting story, I suppose, just to say the unusual dimension of people's conversion, why they want to be a Catholic. This young lady, I asked why the Catholic Church, and she said as a child her nanny was Catholic and her parents were Buddhist, but fairly atheist. Her nanny used to read her bedtime stories from the Bible, and that was her connection with the Catholic Church. So it's not your ordinary normal answer, theological answer, but she had some bond there.
I feel with Catholicism that I've come home.
When I tried to find out more from the perspective of the converts themselves, this was the common feeling expressed by all those who have just joined the church. I spoke to two people in London, one of whom you just heard, and then a woman in Washington, D.C., and a man from Maryland. Let's hear, first of all, what they had to say about their reasons for converting to Catholicism. My first interviewee is Ivo Vermeulen, a Dutchman living in Britain who works for a banking firm in London. He was baptized a Catholic at Easter.
There were various reasons as to why I chose to convert to Catholicism. First of all, my family, at least on my father's side, has always been Catholic, but Catholicism became less and less important in their lives. So for me, it was a matter of going back to our faith. But at the same time, it's also, I think, a point in my life where you reflect on where you stand in life. I'm due to get married, as my future wife is Catholic and then a very devoted Catholic. I decided this was a very good time to go back to Catholicism.
My next is Kate Campbell, a former Anglican who works as an advertising executive in London. She was received into the Catholic Church during the Easter Vigil.
I was actually christened in a very high Anglican church, which was Anglo-Catholic. So I was used to the incense and the genuflecting, but I sort of was moved away from that family-wise, and it's been something I've always felt I never belonged in the Anglican Church. I suppose this really crystallized when I met my now husband, who was a Catholic. I suppose it really came home to me when we were doing the marriage preparation course. We were married in September 2006. The woman who was taking the course at Westminster Cathedral, Rosie, there was something about her. And when she was going through the marriage service and the actual words, something happened in that room. It was the Holy Spirit was there, definitely. I have never seen people so affected. A lot of the girls were in tears, and it was so moving. And it made me think very, very deeply that not only was I about to undertake a Catholic marriage, but I thought this is calling me to actually become a Catholic. But it took another year of me pondering this deeply before I started going to the RCIA class.
Let's now cross over the Atlantic and hear the reasons given by two Americans. The first is Lauren Zumo, a book restorer from Washington, D.C., who was born and raised a Jew, and who was also received into the church during the Easter Vigil.
I guess the first thing was that I met and fell in love with a Catholic man. And when I met Paul, he was extremely religious, and I was not very religious. I grew up celebrating all of the sort of big holidays, you know, twice a year. I went to synagogue and we celebrated Passover, but it wasn't a daily part of our lives. But my now husband was a daily mass goer, and he was very much practicing his religion. And so when I met him, I knew that I liked him immediately, but I knew that we had this big disconnect in our backgrounds. And so I just started going to Mass with him on Sunday just to sort of get to know him and to try and see if this relationship had a future. And I guess it kind of took, and that God had other plans for me that I wasn't expecting. It was, in a way, not joining the enemy, but joining the other team. And it was a struggle to sort of see Jesus as Messiah.
And finally, let's hear from Mike Martz, a printer from Huntington, Maryland, who too has just been received into the church.
Been married to my wife for 35 years. We raised our children, you know, in the Catholic Church, and was kind of a bystander. I should have done a better job. And a couple of things happened last year. We lost a loved one to a tragedy, and my wife's cousin said if one person came back to the church, my daughter's death wouldn't be a loss. And it just kind of triggered something in me, and I decided, I've been thinking about it for years and just decided to do it now.
So, as we've heard, deciding to become a Catholic is rarely a sudden blinding flash of inspiration along the lines of St. Paul's dramatic conversion en route to Damascus. And in fact, very often, a key factor in many people's conversion is the fact that their spouse or future spouse is a Catholic. Mike says although he had been brought up as a Christian, he had drifted away from his faith before he met his Catholic wife.
I was baptized in the Episcopal Church, and I went for a while, but the family was not a real church-going family. My parents didn't go, and then they wanted me to go, and I went for a few years, and then I just kind of drifted away from the church and never quite went back.
Ivo's parents, on the other hand, didn't bring him up in any particular faith at all, but left such decisions entirely up to him.
I was not brought up with any particular faith. My parents wanted to make sure that, as I was brought up, that I would respect each and every religion, that I would make my own decisions. So especially coming from my mother, I think there was a compromise between my parents where they said, well, even though my father was obviously Catholic, there was a decision made that I was going to be raised in a very neutral, so that I was going to make my own judgment, my own decisions. So hence the decision to now convert to Catholicism did not so much come from them, but obviously they do support it.
So, I mean, you weren't going to church on a Sunday, for instance?
I did not, no.
So what about the reactions from family and friends to the decision of these four people to convert to Catholicism? Obviously, when it was a case of their spouse being Catholic, there was great joy over their decision, as we hear from Mike.
They thought it was wonderful. You know, they'd known that I'd gone to Mass, and it was a Christmas and Easter, plus some other Sundays as far as going to Mass and participating. But the final decision was met with a lot of support and a lot of help. My wife attended every Sunday class with me, and it helped her. They allowed her to go to class, and it helped her in her faith.
But for Lauren, who was raised a Jew, the reactions from her own family were not so favorable.
Well, some of my family knows. Some of them do not. So it's still touchy. I'm still not exactly sure how to go there, because I want to maintain good relationships with my family, and then I want to be true to my faith. So it's a balancing act at this point for me. But some of my family has been very supportive and understanding and wonderful. But it does come as a shock to people.
But how has their conversion to Catholicism changed their views on life? All of the converts believe that becoming a Catholic had changed them for the better as a person. Lauren and Mike told me their decision had changed their entire outlook on life.
Well, I'd say it changed just about everything. I really saw the world in an entirely different framework than I did before.
Basically, it's changed my entire outlook on what I watch on television, how I think and how I feel, and my prayer, and being able to forgive people for some things, and had a pretty rough childhood, and it has just made me be a better person.
Kate, too, echoes that feeling of being more aware of the rights and wrongs in our life.
In a way, I suppose I've been coming to terms with Catholicism for some time, since I met my husband, and I've been going to Mass with him for a long time as well. And I think it has changed things. I feel more comfortable. I feel as if I'm part of a family. And it certainly made me more aware of the attacks, I suppose, on Christianity that's going on in the world.
As for Ivo, he feels a greater sense of inner peace on becoming a Catholic.
I think these were questions that I asked myself whilst I was in the process of conversion. So in the strictest sense of the word, there's not such a significant change. I do feel I'm more at ease and more at peace at the moment.
But what does Catholicism give them that other faiths cannot provide? Let's hear first from Kate.
We seem to be living in an increasingly secularized society, which bothers me very, very much. And religion seems to be, Christianity rather, seems to be subject to a lot of contempt and a lot of lack of respect. And I suppose the two things came together, and I felt it was time to stand up and be counted. And to me, the Catholic Church seems to be the church that does not sway with every fashionable wind that's blowing. It seems to stand very true and firm. And I think we all need an anchor in our life. And it seemed to me that the Catholic Church was the place where there is an anchor.
Lauren, too, spoke of the importance of having the truth of her religion, one that is fixed and not diluted by passing fads.
It's the truth aspect of Catholicism that I kind of came through both my faith and sort of intellectual reasoning to realize that it was the truth. So I don't think anyone can compete with that. it's not easy, but I don't think anything that's worth doing is easy. And I think that our souls respond to that. And if it's watered down or too simple or too convenient, I think deep down we know that that's not true. And that's not what God wants for us.
Finally, how would they put into words their feelings and emotions as they were received into the Catholic Church or were baptized during the Easter Vigil? Mike and Kate say they have no hesitation in describing it as one of the greatest days of their life.
probably one of the greatest feelings in my life. It had the parallel when my children were born. I have a peace now that I never had before.
I count my being received into the Catholic Church as the greatest day and happiest day of my life, along with the day that I got married. It's a day I will never forget. It was very moving. I was brimming over with happiness.
So, a moving and emotional experience for all of them. But let's hear Ivo put into words that feeling echoed by so many converts of how it felt like a homecoming.
It was more emotional than I anticipated it to be. More welcoming and more, say, more natural. The actual celebration itself was, in actual fact, the perfect conclusion of coming into the church, and it did feel like coming home, yes.
I was speaking there to Ivo Vermeulen from London, and you also heard the voices of Kate Campbell and Father Dennis Sarsfield from London, Lauren Zumo from Washington, D.C., and Mike Martz from Maryland. For most people, the word hospice is associated with pain and suffering, and above all, death. Many of us would not even relish the idea of stepping inside a place that cares for the terminally ill, as few like to dwell too closely on the uncomfortable truth of our own mortality. But as I've been finding out, a hospice nowadays is far from being a grim and depressing institution where terminally ill people die in agony.
This is a place of much love and much laughter and much hope and much faith, and certainly not a place of doom and gloom.
Denise Mulligan is manager of St. Michael's Hospice in Hastings, England, and she believes it's high time to discard the typical doom and gloom image of a hospice. The commitment of Denise and the other staff to the patients at the hospice shines through when they speak, and she's quick to point out the rewards and privileges involved in their job.
I think here those of us that work here and dearly love our hospice actually have learnt much from our patients, and we support them and they totally enrich our lives. I think when a person is actually nearing the end of their life, that we can actually learn much for the way that people actually live. And I think for us that work in palliative care, we learn something every day from the people that we care for.
With many people automatically equating terminal illnesses with dreadful physical pain, it's not surprising that many patients who first come to any hospice are worried about the agonies they believe must lie in store for them. Maxine Clist is manager of St. Augustine's Nursing Home, which is attached to St. Michael's Hospice. And she says they do everything possible to ensure that dying is pain-free in every sense of the word.
Absolutely. That is what we're here for. It's not just about their physical pain, it's about their emotional pain as well. And we aim through our multidisciplinary to achieve that for them in the way that they want. They're only going to die once. Our job is to make that as peaceful and as dignified for them as possible. And it's about them allowing them to die the way they want to do.
Denise agrees with Maxine and points out that the quality of palliative care has made enormous strides in recent years.
Certainly palliative care, true palliative care, which is what we offer here at St. Michael's Hospice, specialist palliative care, is a very exacting science. You know, diamorphine is certainly one type of analgesia for physical pain, copes particularly with, say, organ pain, but you might get bone pain or nerve pain particularly, which other types of treatment are much more effective. So it's actually that really specialist approach that we offer here at the hospice that offers the best solution.
In addition to removing the pain, Maxine says their motto is to do everything within their power to make their patients' final days as happy as possible. And she told me sometimes they go to incredible lengths to try to satisfy their patients' wishes.
I had a patient who was a breeder of llamas, and her wish was to actually see her llamas before she died. And so we made every arrangement. We got drivers, we got horse boxers, and our only failing at the time was unfortunately due to the foot and mouth restrictions. We weren't able to actually get the llama down. We tried everything possible, and that was enough for her. She knew that we weren't giving up on her wishes.
Even without pain, Death is a frightening prospect for most of us, so how much of a comfort is it to have a strong faith in God? The Reverend Robert Langdon is the resident chaplain at St. Michael's Hospice.
Well, my experience is that where people have a faith, it is enormously strengthening and comforting for them. But a large number of people don't have a faith, and that's where we come in. We're there for them. We seek to offer a ministry of love, compassion, sympathy, and hope. And of course, in a large hospice, such gifts are constantly needed.
He says often the real challenge is persuading people to come to terms with and accept the fact that death is inevitable for all of us.
Anthony was a depressed and agitated man, kept asking, what's it all about? What's the purpose of it all? Why? But a gentle, caring ministry of our whole team, in the end, brought about a peace and a calm and an acceptance. And I noticed that anxiety and fear disappeared from his face during those last days, and he died a peaceful death.
Maxine says emotional pain is sometimes the toughest nut of all to crack when trying to help people come to terms with their own mortality.
We've had some very tough cases. Probably the hardest ones are the ones with emotional pain. I had a gentleman who was a squadron leader in the Second World War, and he saw his whole squadron of young men burnt to death on a raid. And this haunted him all the way through his life. And this came back to him time and time again as a dream. He would be climbing steps, and when the door opened, there would be a big, large fire there that he had to step into. And this was representing what his death was going to be for him. With very, very gentle work through all members of the team, we helped him to come to terms. And I got a call in the middle of the night, and I came in and I went into his room, and his face was just so different. And he then described to me the dream that he had had that night. He climbed up the stairs and he opened the door, and instead of there being fire there, there was a big, beautiful blue sky. And he now knew that death was something that was going to be peaceful and it wasn't going to hurt. And in actual fact, Ian died 2 days afterwards, taking no more painkillers than paracetamol, because his emotional pain had gone now.
But is it tough for them emotionally, looking after people who they know are destined not to be around for much longer? Maxine again.
It can be, but as a team, we work together as a team. We all recognise that there's going to be a patient that's going to push a button in us more than anyone else. And so as a team, we rally together, we support each other. But it's not all darkness, because we have those patients alongside the ones who have got problems who are playing rock and roll music to 4 in the morning, you know, celebrating their life. And so we're part of that. So there is this balance going on all the time with happiness and sadness. But at the end of the day, if our patients have died peacefully, with dignity and with acceptance, then the stress isn't there because we've done our bit.
Do you consider that those are the rewards of your job, or are there other ones as well?
I think the reward for me is knowing that a patient has died, accepting that death is there, that they are embracing it, that they are pain-free, they're symptom-free, and more importantly, that the family are there as well, that they have accepted that this is going to happen, that we can't change the inevitable. Yes, there will be sadness, but if we can help reduce that for them by a degree of acceptance and through lots and lots of love in our community, that's where my satisfaction comes from.
That was Maxine Clist, and you also heard the voices of the Reverend Robert Langdon and Denise Mulligan, all from St. Augustine's Hospice in Hastings, England. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.